This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support from Jerry Lane Chevrolet and First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Your number is 877-217-5757. Emails to talk at talklouisiana.org. It was on this date one year ago today, May 17th, 2020, that Buddy Romer died. He was a person who had a national appeal. Many thought he would be a presidential candidate, and ultimately he was, but not the way he intended. At one point, he was interested in being the Democratic nominee for president. Then he switched parties, and I think he at one point thought he would be viable as a Republican nominee for president. But it unraveled for Buddy Romer in his first term when his tax reform bill failed, and then he vetoed two abortion bills as a Republican. It made him vulnerable, and in an open primary, he got caught in the middle, and he got squeezed by Edwin Edwards and David Duke, finished third, and Buddy Romer never won another election. But those of us who know him benefited from his wisdom and his humor. He was a fun guy. And Lewis Unglesby recently said, "Where are all the characters?" Well, Buddy Romer was a character. He was a true character. Born in Shreveport, actually. Grew up in Bossier City. And that brings us to the gentleman who is with us, also a Shreveport native. Tim Hardy went to Admiral Byrd High School. Buddy Romer went to Bossier High. Tim's a bit younger, but the two of them clicked long ago and far away. Tim, who's now a partner at Brazil Saxe and Wilson, worked for Buddy Romer 1988 to 1992, assistant secretary at DEQ, and then as his executive assistant. So he was right there when Buddy Romer made these big decisions as governor of Louisiana. And at that time, you didn't find many people of color who had places at the table next to the governor. But Tim Hardy was one of those people. And it is an interesting friendship that you had with Buddy Romer and a professional relationship as well. And for those of us who knew him, he was a brilliant guy, no doubt about it. When it came to smarts, he was right up there. Tim?
First, Jim, thank you very much for having me. I'm really pleased to be here. And you're exactly right, Buddy, as I affectionately call him now. I will tell you, during the time he was governor, even after he was governor, I had difficulty referring to him as Buddy, but he liked it. He was kind of simple in that way and rather enjoyed it. But you're exactly right. He was very humorous, extremely bright, thorough, and, you and I have in the past talked about a few circumstances where he demonstrated his humor, and I'm happy to talk about some of those.
Well, that's why you're here, and I don't think we should forget this man. He cared deeply about his state. He stayed here. He didn't go to Washington and become a lobbyist. That would have been an easy paycheck for him, but he became as successful or more than these lobbyists who cashed in, and you can go down the list. Almost every one of the former senators and congresspeople did exactly that. He started two banks, and he was with Joe Tregel, with a company that started in the early 90s, and it did very well. And Buddy Romer was a successful business person. And quite often, as we know, people in Congress have no idea about how a business works, but he did it. And he did it with this affliction, type 1 diabetes. I used to see him at Books a Million, and he would shoot himself up four times a day. He'd just pull out a needle and shoot himself. And sometimes, of course, his insulin would get messed up, and I saw him collapse right there at Books a Million on one occasion. But he would work out, and even though he died at 77 and was in poor health when he died, he got more out of that little body of his than he should have. By all rights, he should have been dead long ago and far away. And he kept that great mind, and he came on this show, Tim, after he had his stroke. And I don't know that he made any other real appearances after that. He did it as a favor to me. His speech was impaired, but the mind was still there. And you knew him well, and we talk about he was smart, he was funny, but he was not particularly good at politics, was he?
No, he wasn't. I believe Buddy was probably better in politics in Washington than in Louisiana, although there were challenges in Washington. I think Tip O'Neill once said that Buddy Romer was not always right, but he was never in doubt. He was one of those boll weevils, as he was known as in Washington. But he was the kind of person that didn't fit neatly into either party because of his views. He sided in many ways with the Reagan administration, but he also fought for sanctions against South Africa. He was one of the people that really pushed for the Martin Luther King national holiday. He was pro-environment, very much so, and we know what he ultimately did with the abortion bill. So although seemingly a conservative, he really didn't fit anywhere very, very well. So, no, not the greatest politician, but a brilliant mind.
Yes, indeed. And in 1987, he came out of nowhere, fifth place, and vaulted to first in the primary. And Edwin Edwards knew it was the end of the trail for him at that time, and he brilliantly withdrew from the election, depriving Romer of a mandate, and then we know Edwards came back in 4 years. But for most of that summer, Romer was in fifth place. He wasn't at 1%, as some people say, but he was probably at about 5%. And as we know, 5% doesn't cut it in an open primary. You need to get to about 25% to have a real shot. And on election day, he was at 33%, got a third of the vote. But Edwin Edwards was second. He got 27%, and Edwards knew that as an incumbent, that was it, so he withdrew. Bob Livingston got 19%. Billy Tozan 10, and Jim Brown 9. It was a cast of all-stars like we have not seen before or since in 1987. We've had some other races with a lot of prominent people, 1971 in particular, but not like 1987. You had five people holding office at the same time in high places and three U.S. congressmen all seeking the office. How did he break through the pack?
Well, Jim, as you know, he had a very fiery campaign. Be honest, I had no expectation that Buddy Romer had much of a chance. But if you will recall, it was, you know, slay the dragon, it was reform, it was brick up the top three floors of the education building. It was all the fiery stuff. And at some point, he just caught on. He caught on, especially with younger people. And within just a two or three weeks, he surged from the back of the pack all the way to the front. It was almost frightening to me, honestly. It's something that we didn't expect.
It was the Romer Revolution, a momentum that came out of nowhere. But the catalyst was all these newspaper endorsements when they really meant something, and a front page endorsement from the Times-Picayune. But Romer was good on television, as were some of the others. I don't think you could say Edwin Edwards was great on television, of course. But he'd been around a long time. Billy Tozan was good on television, but not as good as Buddy Romer. And Jim Brown, of course, had won some races with his political skills. But here was Buddy Romer appealing to the masses in the year of 1987 when he was 43 years old.
The other candidates for governor are talking about who can win. They're offering politics instead of plans. The difference is I have plans for Louisiana. As governor, I'll audit the books and clean up the budget. Reduce the number of state employees through attrition. Put the prisoners to work. Impose tough fines on the polluters. And I'll serve as I've campaigned, free from the special interest. This election is not about a politician winning. It's about our children. It's about our future.
Buddy Romer, 1987. But the bricking up the top three floors of the education building, the slay the dragon, that happened at the press club the week before the primary. And it hit a nerve with the electorate. But John Hill, who was covering the election, he said, this is the damnedest revolution I've ever seen. All these guys driving in with their BMWs and Volvos taking over the Capitol. But he had a coalition, didn't he? And it was an interesting coalition.
He had a very interesting coalition. He had a lot of young people. He had activists. Many say that they were ahead of their times because that was not the climate in Louisiana then. I mean, even when he took office, as you will recall, most of the folks from the Edwards administration still controlled the state capitol. And so he had an uphill battle from the very beginning.
Yeah, Edwards was conspiring to get his job back, and it worked. And at that time, the legislature was not ready for Buddy Romer's reform. And he failed in his tax reform measure, and that was a critical moment. And then he vetoed those two abortion bills. We're about to go to a break, but you were there. Was that a tough decision for him?
I think it was a tough decision, but it's one that when he decided on it, and he pretty much knew he'd be overridden, but he thought that was the best thing because it comported with Roe versus Wade, and he wanted to be with the Constitution.
And he, for all intents, is the last pro-choice governor we had. The two Democrats, along with the Republicans, they were all, quote, pro-life, and Buddy Romer was the last, and he vetoed two bills. One of them survived an overturning, the other did not, but he won in the courts, and we're back after this. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. A year ago today, Buddy Romer, former Louisiana governor, died, and the New York Times put it this way. Buddy Romer, a clean government advocate whose 4 years as Louisiana governor were wedged between terms served by the flamboyant and scandal-plagued Edwin Edwards, died Monday at his home in Baton Rouge, the state capital. He was 77. His son, Charles E. Romer IV, who goes by Chaz, confirmed the death, saying his father had long been treated for type 1 diabetes. A Harvard-educated scion of a prominent North Louisiana farming family, Mr. Romer was elected governor in 1987 as a fiscally conservative Democrat who promised to fix a state budget crisis brought on by falling oil and gas prices. He also pledged to steer clear of scandal in a state where Mr. Edwards' trial on federal corruption charges has dominated much of Edwards' third term and ended in his acquittal in 1986. Buddy Romer, when he was inaugurated March 14, 1988, invited every governor in the country to come to his inaugural, and most governors are busy in March, and only a few took the bait, and I think that was Bill Clinton and Ray Mabus, and they were there. Bill was there with Hillary Clinton, and I remember then-Governor Clinton commenting on Romer's speaking abilities and how he loved it when Romer said, "It's the purtiest state in America," talking about Louisiana. And the man with us is Tim Hardy, who is not only his executive assistant, he was paid for one job, but he had two. He was also assistant secretary of DEQ. And you and Paul Tomplay put in that scorecard for companies. They didn't like that very much, did they? The environmental scorecard.
No, they didn't like it at all. What that was about is Buddy felt pretty strongly, as did Paul Tomplay, that when we looked at the 10-year industrial tax exemption, it should be in some way linked to jobs that were actually created and whether or not there were emissions and pollution coming from those. So we wanted to measure those and maybe not give 100%. If you didn't create that many jobs, you might get a fraction of that, and that did not please industry very much. So we were looking at sort of stepwise approach to the industrial tax exemption.
And he formed, and I think it was Romer who was the initiator, this coalition with Mabus and Clinton, the three Ivy League Southern governors, and this Delta State Compact. They did some good things, but some of the things, of course, were thought about, and ultimately the governors in their wisdom decided not to do them, but you kind of were in the middle of that. It was somewhat of an embarrassment, as I recall, when Romer made a trip to Jackson, Mississippi, and Ray Mabus thought Buddy was there to sign off on something, and it didn't work out that way, did it?
No, Jim, it didn't. Buddy actually summoned me one day from my home on a Sunday and asked that I come to the mansion right away. I came to the mansion, and we had been talking about some business that the Corps was going to undertake with the West Pearl. And we talked substance for a few minutes, and I did inform him that we had not yet arrived on enough information to make a final decision in terms of what we supported and what the Corps was going to do. And he said, "Well, we're going to Mississippi right now, and we're going to meet with Governor Mabus." And I said, "Okay." And we got on the chopper, and we went to Mississippi. And he said, "Look, just stick by what you just told me." And I didn't know what was coming. He said it with a little glimmer in his eye. I wasn't sure what was going on. Well, we landed in Mississippi and were escorted to this stately home. They had maps all over the place, and the room was full of people. And they made a presentation, and Governor Mabus turned to Governor Romer and said, well, buddy, do we have an agreement? And Buddy, in his buddy way, told Governor Mabus, I am impressed with what you have demonstrated today, Ray. And, you know, we always want our states to cooperate to the extent we can, but I have to turn to my top advisor at this moment. And I said to myself, uh-oh. And he turned to me and said, Tim, is this something we can buy off on? And the whole room kind of stopped and turned toward me. And I think you recognize at my age and who I was at that point. And I kind of stammered for a moment, and I said, well, Governor, let me just say I think we need a bit more information. I don't know if we're at a point we can make a decision right now. And Buddy looked around the room and said, well, I think that's no. And I said, oh, wow. And he said, Ray, thank you for having us. We're headed back to Louisiana. And we started walking out, and I'm going to paraphrase a little bit. Romer said to me in so many words, I said, Governor, he said, well, I think it was time for somebody like you to tell the governor of Mississippi no.
He would tell that story at Books a Million.
I'm sure he would.
He said, I thought it was poetic justice that the black man told the governor of Mississippi no.
That's right. That's what he said. I was trying to clean it up.
David in Atlanta. David, you're on with Tim Hardy. Good morning, David.
I remember when Charles Romer was the commissioner of administration under one of the Edwards administrations. He was sent to prison for taking a bribe from Carlos Marcello in the men's room at the Royal Orleans Hotel, $25,000. And I've always wondered, you know, did Edwin Edwards get part of that loot? Of course, he was never accused of anything. But did Buddy Romer run for governor thinking he wanted revenge because probably Edwin Edwards probably was part and partisan to the bribe money that Marcello gave to Charles Romer?
All right. Well, that conviction, by the way, was overturned. But nonetheless, David has part of the feud between Romer and Edwards stemmed from that, I think. Buddy Romer felt like his father got the shaft. Is that fair? Tim's shaking his head yes.
That was generally thought of. I don't have any personal knowledge, but of course that's been around for a long time.
But those two guys had a love-hate relationship, and they both had great political skills, and they knew it, and they knew it about each other. And they knew each other really well. It was a fascinating relationship, but Buddy Romer did not have the same antipathy to Edwin Edwards that he had toward David Duke. He could not abide Duke.
I agree. In Buddy's own words, he would say often at times that their bloodlines ran back together, talking about Edwards and himself. As you know, he campaigned strongly for Edwards when he was at Harvard. He wrote speeches for him, so. And we always say in jest, if you could combine the talents of both of them, you would have a magnificent politician.
And they both were elected at age 43 as U.S. congressmen.
That's correct.
Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, you're on with Tim Hardy. Hi, Phil.
Good morning, Tim. So if I understand it, I think Mr. Romer put his marriage at risk. Didn't he enroll his children into the public school system here in East Baton Rouge Parish?
I think they went to public schools here.
Yes, they did. In fact, I think Dakota was at U High shortly after my children were
which
there.
Which is a different kind of public school, as we know.
I understand.
But it was a public school.
Yes.
And Romer, of course, had a great passion for education. He had worked in the education department.
Yes, he did.
Under Kelly Nix, didn't he, years ago?
That's correct.
But yeah, I know, you know you've got a trove of stories. Do you have a good one you can share with us?
I've got so many. Let me tell you one that I find fairly interesting. I'm at home asleep one night, and I get a call. when I hear the state trooper on the phone, I know, uh-oh, something's up. And he says, hold for the governor. He puts Governor Romer on, and Governor Romer says he's just talked to the White House. And there has been an explosion off the coast of Houston, an oil tanker, and oil was spilling. And he told me at that moment, I want you to get on the phone with the White House. I want you to talk to John Sununu. I want you to talk to the Coast Guard. And don't let one drop hit our coastline. Well, I didn't know exactly how I was going to stop the oil from getting to the coastline. But then he told me this. He said, I want you to call me every 4 hours and give me a status update. Every 4 hours. So I dealt with the federal agencies, the state agencies. I tried to coordinate as much as I could, get all the information. And I will tell you, that's one of the first times ever in the history of oil spills, I believe, we used bioremediation on an oil spill. That is, having bugs basically eating the oil. But I'll finish that.
We'll spend a bit more time with Tim Hardy when we return after this. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757. A few more minutes with Tim Hardy, who was executive assistant to Buddy Romer, the governor of Louisiana in 1988-1992, who died 1 year ago today. And Buddy Romer was a person who was a man about town. He chose to live the last, what was it? He died in 2021. So we're talking, geez, pretty long time. 35 years of his life. He lived in Baton Rouge most of his life. And, he loved this city, and he left a mark on politics, and he came from the North Country. He the last Louisiana governor probably in my lifetime and maybe the lifetime of anyone who's listening from North Louisiana, Buddy Romer. But Tim Hardy knew him well, and a listener or two has asked about the abortion decision and its impact on his political fortunes. I don't think it did him any harm, but Buddy Romer may have been ahead of the pack. I'm reading today, New York Times, Tim Hardy. Starbucks has announced it will reimburse travel expenses for employees who need abortions and cannot get them within 100 miles of their home. This is in response to the decision coming from Roe v. Wade. Starbucks, which of course has many outlets in Louisiana, has 240,000 American employees and 9,000 stores. So the revolution that Buddy Romer was a part of, it was a revolution on many fronts, but one of them was this.
That's exactly right. Jim, I was there, and I saw him wrestle with that decision. It was not an easy decision for him, but I think he just felt in the final analysis that he did not want to do something contrary to what the Supreme Court had held in Roe versus Wade, especially the bill that was before him had no exceptions.
And he vetoed two bills.
Yes.
And he won in the courts.
Yes, he did.
And the first time they didn't override him, it was saved by a 23-16 vote in the Senate. Three senators from North Louisiana protected Romer, Foster Campbell being one of them.
Right.
And it was a case in which they came back and took a flag-burning bill and amended it on the final night of the session and embarrassed the governor. But ultimately, I think the state of Louisiana paid the biggest price. But Romer probably surrendered his political career with that decision. And I have said this, and people find it hard to believe because they weren't there then. But in 1987, you were there. You were at the table. There was another guy at that table who was advising the governor named John Kennedy, wasn't there?
Yes, John was there. John was special counsel. Of course, Tom Casey was executive counsel. A lot of people thought that John was actually executive counsel. He was not. Tom Casey was executive counsel. John was special counsel. He was a Democrat in those days.
He was, and pro-choice.
Yes, he was.
Yes. What impact did Romer have on you?
Jim, let me just say, Buddy had me doing things where I thought at the end of the day, that I was in over my head. And he convinced me that I was not. I will tell you, there was one occasion. It was a tough decision. It had to do with an oil lease off the Louisiana coast. And he didn't want it to take place and told me to summon all the resources of the state to fight that in court. I got in touch with the Attorney General's office, and we started marshaling a lawsuit. We were at the old state capitol one night. He was having people coming and greet him one by one. And he, you know how Buddy was. He had his bow tie off and his jacket off and in a Buddy way. And he summoned me to him. He beckoned me to come toward him. And I did, and he said in his Romer way, where are we on that suit? And I told him, I said, well, I talked to, and I mentioned another person on staff, and he looked at me. One of the few times I think Buddy truly showed anger toward me. And he said to me, I didn't ask you what anybody else thought. I asked you what you think. And if I ask you again, and you have to go and check with somebody else, you're not going to have a bad problem. So I saw at that moment, he wanted to hear what I had to say. I think that impacted me for the rest of my life. I don't think I was ever intimidated by much. Now, he said it a little bit differently.
Yeah, I can hear him now. Take the shackles off.
That's exactly right. That's what he said. I think you heard that one, too.
I heard some of those stories.
Yeah.
But he had a good memory, too.
He had a very good memory, and, you know, he and I were friends. He was not just my boss, but for whatever strange reason, he and I became very, very dear friends.
He was a good man, and I miss him. I wish he were.
So do I.
Wish he were at Books A Million's no longer open, but he was a fixture at Barnes & Noble for many years, and I'll remember him until the day I die.
Jim, the only time in my life I've been to two funerals for the same person.
Baton Rouge and
Shreveport. Yes, I did.
Yeah. And like Buddy Romer, Jim Hardy came from the North Country of Louisiana, and we're glad you're here. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you.
And in studio, another friend, a guy who in the year of 1977, on the day before Memorial Day, May 29th, Zia Tamami made his debut as a jazz announcer, now has the longest jazz show in North America, 45 years, as in a few days. And the other day I was listening to him, and Robin Dowse pulled this up. She found it pretty quickly. Ranked number 10, by the way, from Rolling Stone, is the greatest song of all time. A guy named Ray Charles, who I hear quite frequently on your show.
Well, you know, what's interesting, when this song came out, all the radio stations that were boycotting that and said, you know what, the way he's singing, he's insinuating some really sexy stuff on the air, so don't play it. And now when we look back and say, that was very innocent compared to what's going on these days on the air.
But listen to this.
Beautiful.
Hey, mama, don't you treat me wrong. Come and love you, daddy, all night long, all night long. Hey, hey, all right. See the girl with the diamond ring? She knows how to shake that thing, all right now, now. I'm gonna send you back to Arkansas. Oh, yes, ma'am. You don't do right.
The great Ray Charles.
Brother Ray.
Yeah.
The genius of Ray Charles.
He was amazing. But Zia, you're amazing. 45 years. When you started on that day, I remember you were in the stadium. I was at LSU just a few months after that, enrolling as a freshman. The day Elvis died, I came to LSU.
Yeah.
So it was about 80 days before I arrived, Zia makes his debut, and 45 years later, you're still doing it.
Well, Charlotte, my wife, the other day, I think it was early May, said, this is your 45th. I said, 45th of what? She says, your radio show. I said, really? I don't keep up with it anymore. You know, it just comes 35, 40, 45, but it's a pleasure to be on the air because people, they really enjoy what we are doing.
And Zia, by training, is an engineer. He knew Tim Hardy well from Tim's days at DEQ. But
absolutely. We did a lot of nice projects together.
But you came from Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And
correct.
At a time when it was tough for people from your land in this area.
Well, you know, when I came, Shah was still in power. And my father was Shah of Iran confidant. He was an international lawyer. And, you know, at that time, probably really the number of Iranian students in U.S., they were just in top of their classes, and they, you know, a lot of entrepreneurs and all that. It's, you know, then of course, you know, when the revolution happens and things start, You know,
79.
Yeah, 79, which is unbelievable. I was skiing in Colorado, and my brother, who's now just retired from United Nations as a diplomat, he called me and said, Shaw is ready to leave. And I couldn't believe it. It was almost like a joke. But that's what it was.
Well, you're another fellow. When you came to Baton Rouge, I don't expect you thought you'd be here for
No, not at all. No, as a matter of fact, I had a scholarship from University of Michigan, or Michigan State, rather, in East Lansing, and University of Arizona. So my brother said, why don't you go to Baton Rouge and check their geology department? We heard that it's very good. So I came, and next thing you know, here we are. You know, when first degree, second degree, then I met my mm-hmm. wife from Lake Charles, and 50 years here.
Mm-hmm. In the facility at then WLSU, which became WPRG, which mm-hmm. became KLSU. It's moved around a bit, but you and I met in the bowels of the stadium, a stone's throw from the visitors' locker room.
Yeah, East Stadium.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, you could hear the pipes, you know, the heating pipes in the dormitory. People, they're banging mm-hmm. on it, and we could hear it in the control room.
Well, in 1981, I was working with the radio station, the Reveille, also in the right down the hall from us.
Correct.
And I lived on the third floor, so it was one-stop shopping.
That's right. Yeah, Hatcher Hall. But really, a state-of-the-art station that we have, that even commercial stations, they don't have it here.
And you do your thing across the city at...
In 30 minutes after that, or 45 minutes to WBRH.
Yeah, on Sundays, so...
It's a marathon. It's a
busy day.
Yeah, it is. It is.
4 hours each place, right?
Which is really, these days, is too much, really. I mean, 8 hours on all your toes.
Well, you know, the music is the music, and it's great music, and you're preserving it. That's wonderful, and you know much about it, but... The voice. You obviously love what you do, and that is conveyed when you talk about it. I think that's why you've had such
passionate.
Staying power. Yeah, yeah. That's why you're still there.
Right.
Nobody
right.
sounds like Zia.
A signature. Well, you know, the music is great, you know, and it's unfortunately, you don't hear it on too many radio stations. So, it was interesting. About a few months ago, I get a call from XM Radio, which I thought is a prank. And they said, no, you know, we're interested. We heard about you. I'm like, really? In New York? Yeah. So maybe down the road we'll see if we
You're
can do 1 hour.
Still a young guy. Still a young guy.
God willing, if I'm in good health, maybe we do 1 hour on the satellite radio XM.
And Zia's been leading the pack on keeping jazz alive in Baton Rouge. The River City Jazz Master Series is in full bloom. And when we return, we'll hear a bit more about that. We might take a call or two as well. We have a few more minutes with Zia the Cat, the one-of-a-kind air personality who's been doing it 1977 to the present without a break. We'll talk more after this. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. In a few moments, we're going to hear from the amazing Melissa Phoebos, who has a national bestseller, Girlhood, now in paperback. It created quite a firestorm of controversy and attention, and some might say she's causing good trouble, and we'll hear from her in just a moment. We're wrapping it up with Zia the Cat, 45 years on the air. Before we take a call or two very briefly, your thoughts about the Jazz Master Series.
This coming Wednesday, day after, well, tomorrow, the incredible NEA Jazz Master Donald Harrison is going to come to town with his sextet at Manship Theater at 7:30. You don't want to miss that. We're going to induct him in Professor Alvin Batiste Hall of Fame. And what a concert that's going to be. A little bit of funk, a little bit of New Orleans, and straight ahead jazz. So that's this coming Wednesday at 7:30 and approaching our 16th year.
Very good.
Yeah, nonprofit.
You and Derek Gordon got it off the ground.
Absolutely. And, it was a pleasure working with him. Yep, missing him.
And we won't be able to get to all of you, but we'll get to one or two of you if you're brief. Reggie and Zachary. Reggie, you're on with Zia. Hi, Reggie.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Hello, Zia. Wes Montgomery on this end. He knows what I'm talking about. Zia does. I just appreciate what he has done for all the years. Just simply do what you do and keep going.
Thank you, Reggie.
Paul in Opelousas. Hello, Paul. You're on with Zia.
Yes, Zia. Hi. Good morning. Good morning. Thanks for what you're doing. And I brought a young kid from Opelousas up to one of the shows. Did great. Your opinion, Gregory Porter, jazz or just good music?
jazz and good music both. I mean, he is absolutely original, and his vocals, I mean, the guy is one of a kind, and it was a pleasure to bring him 7-8 years ago, and we did a great 2 shows with him. He's okay. Absolutely out of this world.
We got 30 seconds. Final caller for Zia the Cat Tamami, Barry in Mid-City. Hi, Barry.
Good morning. Do you stand up as you do your show like Mr. Carter at RKF?
Not only that, I also dance in studio. Thank God we don't have a camera. But, yeah, I really get into it. Absolutely.
Thank you, Barry. And thank you, Zia. Keep going.
Thank you.
And let's do this on a regular basis.
You got it. Thank you so
much. My dear friend.
Take care.
And as Zia would say, my colleague, Zia the Cat, for 45 years. Melissa Phoebos is with us. She is the author of the memoir Whip Smart, the essay collection Abandon Me. And she is a remarkable writer. The latest work is Girlhood, now in paperback. When it was first published in hardcover last year, Melissa examined narratives that women are told about what it means to be female and what it takes to free oneself from them. And Melissa, I think you must have known when you embraced this topic, you were going to hit a nerve or two.
You know, I hoped that I would. I certainly hit a nerve or two in myself as I was writing it. So that's the only thing I really knew for sure. But I'm really glad it's resonated with folks all over the place.
You have written in Girlhood is a part of this about women in their bodies and the perceptions. And recently there was a New York Times piece from you just a few days ago about women and their breasts. And this is a topic, of course, that some might find taboo, but you bring it out in the open, and I am very pleased with your observations, your thoughts.
Oh, thank you. That means a lot. Yeah, I definitely, every time I write something that's so deeply personal as, you know, writing about my adolescent sexual experiences or my body image or my breast reduction, I think, I'm never doing this again. I'm going back to fiction immediately after this. But writing for me is really my best way of thinking and of sort of inducing transformation in myself. And a lot of healing has come out of it. So I can't really stop doing it. And I guess I'm not sorry about that in the end.
I see you you commented saying, when I decided to have surgery, I thought to myself, I will never write about this. Then I underwent the experience, and it illuminated so much that I needed to think through it the best way I know how, and that you have done.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's been very true for almost everything I've written, and most of the chapters in Girlhood concern experiences from my adolescence and childhood all the way through my adulthood until now. Most of them are about experiences that I thought, oh, I can never say this aloud to another person. I don't think I could ever talk about it. And then I have a little conversation with myself in privacy, in writing. And by the time I'm done, my relationship to that experience and to that subject has changed so much. I've really made friends with it, and I end up wanting to share it with other people. So I do.
Do you think you would have been able to have the same reception a decade or a generation ago, writing the same way you are now and doing so compellingly?
Oh, no. I don't think I would have been published. You know, I published my first book in 2010, so that was over a decade ago. And, you know, it was intense and personal writing, but it didn't get, you know, I think people are ready for a different kind of conversation, a more intimate kind of conversation. And, you know, it's been to my benefit in some ways, but I'm really glad I've been able to connect with so many people around this book.
Well, Girlhood has been featured since it appeared first last year in hardcover in many places. Are you, even though you've had remarkable success, are you heartened by the positive attention you've gotten from this book?
I really am. You know, I've always written about the things that are in my heart, and they haven't always been things that people are comfortable talking about. And I feel so grateful that we're at a point socially and in terms of media where, you know, I got to be on the Morning Joe, the MSNBC mm-hmm. morning show, talking about adolescent girls and, you know, slut shaming. And it just, I was pinching myself the whole time because it felt like such a lucky place to be and gave me so much hope.
Well, Girlhood is now available in paperback, and it is an amazing story about exactly that, with characteristic honesty, lyricism, insight. Melissa Phoebos examines forces that shape girls and the adults they become. At what point in life do girls come to grips with the fact that their bodies often have a narrative that goes way beyond the personal appearance?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it varies for people, you know. Some people never really get in touch with that, you know, and that's part of the reason I wanted to write this book, because for me, you know, I had thought I was really in touch with my body and my sexuality and sort of had recovered from some of the early experiences I had. And it wasn't until, you know, my 30s that I started to do a really deeper level of granular work in myself to examine the patterns that I was sort of acting out in relationships and even in my daily interactions that were defined by scripts that I hadn't chosen, you know, and sort of ruts that I had been in since my early life, and started doing the like slow work of undoing that and to recoup a little bit more of my own agency. And I just wanted to share that with other folks of all genders to really give an example and show that it's possible.
And you have written openly about your relationship with Donica. That's a place that I'm sure it took some courage to go.
Yeah. You know, my wife is, she's also a writer, and so that helps. But, you know, I show her, she appears in my work a lot because she's been so instrumental in my own growth and transformation. And, but I run everything by her and make sure she's comfortable with it. And she's very accepting. I'm very grateful to her for being willing to be a character in my work.
How did you meet?
We met through our work. I read her first book of poetry, Bestiary, and I rarely do this, but I loved it so much. I wrote her a fan letter, basically, and we sort of struck up a correspondence and met a few months later, and it was all over at that point. You know, we probably could have gotten married the next day, but we waited a few years.
So it was love at first sight, as they say. Or
pretty
close.
It was about as close, yeah, it was as close to it as I believe in, for sure.
Well, you are brilliant. You write irreverently and compellingly, and those two things don't often go together, but you've pulled it off and do it well in Girlhood and your other works, but you're a striking physical presence. It does, you know, some people would be offended by me saying this, but I think it is part of you, and mm-hmm. I would hope that you're proud of the way you come across to people.
No, I'll take them as a compliment. So thank you. Yeah, I've worked pretty hard to be sort of present inside myself. And, you know, it's funny when I meet people, especially now in the pandemic, because everything's online, everyone's always so shocked because I'm very short. I'm like a very small person.
What is very short?
I'm under 5. I'm 5'1" and some change. But you know, I'm a college professor, and so I project really authoritative energy.
Yes, indeed. Dynamite comes in small packages, but
that's right. That's right.
How do your students receive you? You're now, you know, you're young, but you're now mm-hmm. ahead of them. Mm-hmm. How do they receive mm-hmm. you?
You know, I love my students so much. I think, you know, sometimes when I come into the classroom, they've read some of my work and they have an idea and they, you know, their eyes are a little bit wide. And part of what I consider my job and my work as a teacher and a writer is to show people that you can write about personal things, you can be transparent and say the hard things out loud and be really comfortable, and there's nothing to be ashamed of. And so I really try to model that for my students. And, you know, and I also make it really clear that I'm always available to talk about writing about personal stuff, and I am never available to talk about my personal stuff in the classroom. And I think that's a relief for everyone when I make that clear at the beginning.
We do have to roll, but the book is Girlhood from Melissa Phoebos, signature support from First Financial and Jerry Lane Chevrolet.